Blog Talk Radio.
Do you think that race plays a part in wealth distribution, or either a mindset that you can't or cannot?
Yeah. No.
You don't?
No, I don't. I don't. Hey, you and I, we're proof. Why would race have anything to do with it? Put your mind to what you want to do and go for that. It's kind of like religion to me. It's a good excuse for not getting there.
Where are we in the United States of America in race relations, and what you see from day to day in your life?
Skip, they wouldn't want to ask me that. They wouldn't want my answer to represent it, because God knows I have been nothing but blessed. My whole path, these 33 years have been nothing but a blessing. I've never dealt with racism, and I'm glad I didn't have to.
There is a class of colored people who make a business of keeping the troubles, the wrongs, and the hardships of the Negro race before the public. Some of these people do not want the Negro to lose his grievances because they do not want to lose their jobs. There is a certain class of race problem solvers who don't want the patient to get well. That was said by Booker T. Washington.
How are we going to get rid of racism until...
Stop talking about it. I'm going to stop calling you a white man.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask you to stop calling me a black man.
You know, it's frustrating to me that people take race and they make it personal. You know what I mean? Like, we're at a loss in this generation. If you look at it in the 80s, Archie Bunker was a stark racist. Stark. If you don't know who Archie Bunker is, look him up. All in the Family, great show.
You heard him.
The Jeffersons, stark racist. Fred Sanford, stark racist. But you know what black people and white people did? They laughed. You watch 48 Hours with Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte. Both of them hated each other because he was black and because he was white. You know what they did? They laughed.
But I asked you what the racial breakdown was of your audience. Do you remember this? You told me the only black face you could see in the whole audience was your makeup artist. I believe that's what you said, and she was in the front row, right? A lot of white kids love rap.
Yes.
Explain that. What does that say to you? What's the message of it? What's the bigger picture of it?
I don't want to be bashed, because I don't want to sound like I'm on the wrong, if there is a side, but I thought that was clearly a message that there was no such thing as racism. That's what I thought that was.
You know, I said, and it's probably getting me in trouble, but I said to some of my colleagues recently, so I know that it's an issue, but it seems like every single day on television I'm talking about race, and it's because of the news cycle, it's in the news, but sometimes I get so tired of talking about it, I want to just go, this is over, can we move on?
And if you talk about it, it exists.
Right.
Yeah. It's not like it exists and we refuse to talk about it, but making it a bigger issue than it needs to be is the problem we have.
Mm-hmm. And right now, we are in a society where we can't have a conversation because no one's willing to listen.
People are just shouting.
People are just shouting. People are walking down the street, hashtagging everything, but no one's listening.
Using wrong examples to present an argument leads us nowhere forward. I understand the emotion, and I respect my opposition, but when you go into the areas of making false charges and living in the past, you do not address the issues of the present.
And, you know, incarceration rates in America has been a problem, especially as opposed to minorities, and Roman delves into this, the issues around the legal system. Do you think we've made any headway in the legal
system? I think it's more important to make headway in our own house. By the time the system comes into play, the damage is done. They're not locking up seven-year-olds.
In the 1960s, 80%+ of blacks were two-parent homes. Today, that is reversed completely the other way.
I was in Chicago a couple of four weeks ago, and we saw these little kids on bikes with masks on the side of their head, like five or six of them. And the driver said, yeah, they're little yummies. I said, who? He said, little yummies. Look up. Google Lil Yummy. Mm. Lil Yummy was an 11-year-old murderer.
Wow.
And you look at his picture, you'll see the headshot of him, and he's like this. and he got murdered at 11 by a 14-year-old.
Wow.
Who's doing life now, and a 16-year-old.
That makes no sense.
You blame the system's father.
No one wants to talk about perception when it comes to racial profiling. No one wants to talk about stereotypes when it comes to racial profiling.
Blacks are convinced that the number one issue facing the country right now is social justice, racist white cops, discrimination, systemic racism, microaggression, whatever new word they come up with, and it's a bunch of nonsense.
This is what I know. I'm a certified scuba diver. My first day of class, they told me this. When you're in shark-infested waters, everything in that water is considered a threat until proven otherwise. If it's a guppy, it could be a shark until you know it's a guppy. And I think as black men, we need to realize we're in shark-infested waters. And if we don't sit our young men down and we don't talk to them about perception, if we don't talk to them about stereotypes, we're doing them a huge disservice.
It starts in the house. It starts in the home. And yeah, well, my father got locked up. Well, where was his father?
Yeah.
You know, like I did talk about my three closest friends, and they did, you know, 15 to 25. One did 28, this and that. I was the only one of the three that had a father in my life, even though my parents were together. But I still had a father who was a gentle man and a good example, and they didn't. We can blame the system if we want, but they didn't lock any of us up at seven.
Yeah.
We were all doing enough to get locked up at 13. My parents sent me in another direction. They didn't have anybody to help them, and they kept doing what they was doing, and the system got them. So I don't. The system is rigged, but why? All the more reason not to help it.
The number one problem domestically facing this country is a breakdown of the family, and President Obama said it. I didn't. A black kid, or kid, not just a black kid, a kid raised without a dad is 5 times more likely to be poor and commit crimes, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, and 20 times more likely to end up in jail. So you're far more likely to end up in jail without having a dad than you are because of a white racist cop.
Prime example, I got pulled over by the police, come over to my window, flash his light in my face, hand on my pistol. I can handle that two ways. I can start yelling and screaming and tell him he a racist and he don't know me. Ah, you doing this wrong. Or I can say, yes, officer, no, officer, are we done, officer? And both of them are going to have drastically different outcomes.
Half the homicides in this country are committed by and against black people. Last year, there were 14,000 homicides, not talking about suicides. I'm talking about homicides.
Mm-hmm.
Half of them were black, 96% of them black on black of that 7,000. Where's the Black Lives Matter people on that?
What happens with young black men, everything is susceptible to the question of your manhood.
Mm.
And what's going on in these streets ain't got nothing to do with my manhood. If I'm going to fight a police, I'm going to fight him in a controlled environment, a court of law. I'm not going to fight him on the streets.
In Baltimore, where Freddie Gray was killed, Freddie Gray died in a van. I shouldn't say was killed, died in a van.
Yeah.
You have a city that's 45% black. City council is 100% Democrat. The majority of city council is black. The top cop at the time was black. The number two cop was black. The majority of the command staff is black. The mayor is black. The AG is black. And yet here we are talking about racism. I mean, it's absurd.
All cops aren't bad cops. 99% of cops are really good dudes and women. 99% of the people I've met that are cops are dope. I have a lot of friends that are cops. But that 1%, that's the problem. And you want to give yourself every opportunity not to end up a statistic.
965 people were shot by cops last year and killed. 4% of them were white cops shooting unarmed blacks. In Chicago in 2011, 21 people were shot and killed by cops. In 2015, there were 7. In Chicago, which is a third black, a third white, and a third Hispanic, 70% of the homicides are black on black. About 40 per month, almost 500 in the year. Per year, last year in Chicago, and 75% of them are unsolved. Where is the Black Lives Matter on that? The idea that a racist white cop and shooting unarmed black people is a peril to black people is BS.
Black History Month, you find?
Ridiculous.
Why?
You're going to relegate my history to a month?
Oh, come on.
What do you do with yours? Which month is White History Month?
Well,
come on, tell me.
Well, I'm Jewish.
Okay. Which month is Jewish History Month?
There isn't one.
Oh. Why not?
Yeah.
Do you want one?
No.
All right. I don't either.
I don't want a Black History Month. Black history is American history.
Abraham Lincoln, as my colleague said, fought a war to preserve the Union. That republic allowed for the people of the United States, under our Constitution, to amend it, therefore removing slavery, and then moving forward to the Voting and Civil Rights Act, and also the suffrage movement for women.
At the same time, and you would say it as strong as anyone, it's no excuse for bombing and destroying your own neighborhood. And burning down wherever it's happening. Burning down storefronts and stores that people...
with mobs
who,
is how they get turned into that.
Yeah.
What's to be gained? You know, if you stop for one split second to think, burning and looting doesn't help you in any way.
I understand y'all upset. But like it was already said, I doubt y'all half as upset as I am. So if I'm not over here wilding out, if I'm not over here blowing up stuff, if I'm not over here messing up my community, then what are y'all doing?
I will always continue to say that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating. I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for freedom and justice. I feel that violence will only create more social problems than they will solve.
Let's switch it up, y'all. Let's switch it up.
Yeah. Amen.
Do this peacefully. Please. My brother moved here from Houston, and I used to talk to him on the phone. He loved it here. He started driving truck. He was good. So I know he would not want y'all to be doing this.
So I will continue to condemn riots and continue to say to my brothers and sisters that this is not the way. Continue to affirm that there is another way.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to your place. Tonight, Wild Bill wanted to share anything he could find in regard to what's happening right now in our country with the recent killing of George Floyd. We had some positive things to take note of, but at night we saw how destruction and violence took over the streets of many cities around the country. Bill, being a former policeman, tried to explain the process of making an arrest when a person resists. The job is to take charge. The job is not to fight people. He shared how he got hurt by people saying they needed their position changed. But like many, all he could do was hold in his mind was the man saying, "I can't breathe, please, I can't breathe." Tonight, you are going to hear an interview of a Black man who had been a police officer. His name is Brandon Tatum. You can look him up online, as he wants to try to help bridge the gap of race of many people think they understand it. We have reached out to him, and hopefully he'll call into the show to be able to answer questions. But if not, we hope to get him on with a live show later. This is the key point. The Holy Ghost is moving in church and with people right now to move up to another level. Bill thinks Satan is using all of this to get people distracted, frustrated, and angry so they cannot respond to the love of God with the love of God. And now let's have a listen.
All right. More importantly, joining me today is a former Arizona police officer and now the co-founder of the Blexit movement,
Brandon Tatum, welcome to the Rubin Report.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. I'm excited to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. You do realize that your shirt is going to trigger an awful lot of people on the internet.
Well, I'm hoping so. I'm hoping so. I mean, I don't see why. We live in America. People should love the flag. They should love the concept of America first. So if they're triggered, that's their fault.
You must feel very comfortable in my studio. I've got a flag over there.
Oh, yeah.
Big American flag over there. Constitution, Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
So we're off to a good start.
Cool.
All right, there's a lot of stuff I want to talk to you about, and
right.
I've wanted to have you in here for a while. So first off, for people that know absolutely nothing about you, I don't know anything about your childhood, upbringing, family life, that kind of stuff, before we get into law enforcement and Blexit and the rest of it.
Okay, well, I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. I'm a Texas boy, Cowboy fan, by default, I could say. I mean, they're doing good this year, so I like them.
Yeah, legally you have to be a Cowboy
fan.
Yeah,
I have to be. Yeah. My dad is a Cowboy fan. You know, he used to work at the stadium, so I'm I guess, thrusted into the atmosphere of Cowboy Nation. So, but I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. My parents were split my whole life, all that I can remember, you know, and it was slightly an adversity, right? Because we have my dad, his dad wasn't around, my mom, her dad wasn't around. My grandmother, uniquely enough, had my mother at 12 years old.
Wow.
She was raped, and she had my mom at 12, you know, so that was kind of the foundational idea of kind of how me and my brother was raised. Both parents are really good parents. My dad is a firefighter. He's actually a chief. So I grew up in a very diverse background, you know, because we had a lot of my mom's side of the family, what I would say was poor, uneducated, poor. High school graduation was like going to college on my mom's side of the family. A few of my family members are doing life in prison. So I come from a diverse type of atmosphere, you know. You have the good, the bad. My dad did a wonderful job raising us. We lived with both my mom and dad. Went to different schools, private schools, public schools. But my high school was Dunbar High School, Paul Laurence Dunbar High School, named after the famous black poet Paul Laurence Dunbar. It was violent, man. It was violent. You know, people pulling guns on each other in the parking lot, fights.
Wow.
I mean, people come off the streets fighting in the school. But what it did do was it presented a atmosphere where we can excel in athletics. And I can say, let me go back to when I was eight, because that was one of the pivotal points in my life. At 8 years old, I got arrested for smoking marijuana in a vacant house.
8 years old.
And eight is when I stopped smoking marijuana. When I was seven, we used to smoke marijuana with my cousins. And when I say marijuana, for people that know about smoking weed, we weren't smoking joints. We were smoking blunts.
Yeah.
My older cousins would go buy weed, and then we'll come together and we'll smoke it. My parents had no idea what we were doing. Until we got busted that time when I was eight. My brother was 10.
Jeez.
So
I mean, I can't even imagine what the mind of an eight-year-old smoking weed.
Yeah, I got a nine. My son is nine. He just turned nine, and I couldn't imagine him picking up weed and smoking it like we were.
Jeez.
We were also...
Wait, you get busted. What happened?
Well, we got busted, the vacant house. I mean, they came in like the SWAT team. They put guns on us and everything. And they put us in a squad car. We went to the detention center. And we initially thought that they were going to call my cousin's parents, because their parents really was, they didn't care much, man. You know, we were going to get in trouble. We were never going to tell my dad it was going to go away. But for some reason, they called Mr. Tatum there. And my dad is a strong man, you know, and he came in there like he was ready to fight, you know. He came in there and, I'm going to kill him. And I was telling my brother, I was like, you know, I hope they leave us in here, man. We're about to get the whooping of a lifetime. But the thing that I love that my dad did, and it really changed my life, is that we didn't get a whooping. He didn't whoop us. He set me down. We were on a ride home. He set me down and said, look, Brandon, if you don't act with integrity and you don't change your ways, you will never play in the NBA. Because at the time, I wanted to be like Michael Jordan. I mean, that hurt me more than any whooping could. And it kind of set me on a path of feeling like, you know, I need to do better, man. You know, I love my cousins, but we can't hang out with them no more and get into trouble that'll end up causing me to lose my future.
More importantly than anything else, how are your basketball skills now?
Oh, trash. I'm trash at basketball. I hate to say it. I know that stereotypically I'm supposed to be
good.
Oh,
so this was the 8-year-old dream of being
Michael
Jordan.
This was the 8-year-old dream.
Oh,
that dream died. Real, when I couldn't dribble with my left and I couldn't shoot from the 3-point, that dream died.
All right. Well, you know what? I was actually going to do some of this stuff later, but...
Yeah.
So this obviously relates to the black family, and every time anyone talks about this, if you're white, let's say, they're going to immediately say you're racist for even bringing this up, and yet I hear this sort of story so often, that what is happening to the black family, or what has happened in, say, the last couple of decades, is sort of the root of the problem here.
Yeah.
Do you think that's fair to say? And
100%.
And how did your dad not succumb to that?
Well, 100%, I think, is the root of the problems. You know, when you're a young man, you've grown up with no direction. Where do you go? Who do you look to? You got to look to people that are influential males in the community, and they didn't have a dad. So you have a kind of a matriculation of this fatherless home issue going on, and people trying to be fathers without having examples of what a real father is. So now you're going to gang members and other dudes like our cousins, you know, and we didn't have to because we had a strong dad, which helped us. But you still want to be like mm-hmm. your big cousins because they're cool and it's, you know, it's kind of trendy what they're doing. And it leads young men down the wrong path. But unfortunately, and I guess fortunately for me, my father was a strong man. And I think that him not having his dad around really made him feel like, you know, I need to do better. And my dad obviously had a little bit of training being a father because he had to help take care of his younger brothers. And so my dad probably always had that in him, but him being a strong man, him standing on principles really saved us. I'm not going to lie. You know, my mom is great. My mom was way more lenient than my dad. You know, my mom was the cool mom. You know what I mean? And I hate to say it, we kind of took advantage of that. Me and my brother didn't have as much respect for my mom as we did my father. He was strict, no cussing in the house. Back in the day when we had no cell phones, you know, he'll pick the phone up while you're talking to somebody on the phone and be like, it's time to go to bed, you know, and hang the phone up on you. So it was really beneficial. And if I didn't have my dad, I would not be here today.
Why do you think it's so hard to talk about that? So, for example, my parents have been married 44 years now with ups and downs and good and bad and all that stuff, but they still live in the house that I grew up mm-hmm. in. And I know that the roots of that give you some stability in life. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make you perfect. You're yeah. still going to make mistakes and all those things, but it gives you some sense of like a consistency in the world. It's so obviously something that we should all want or aspire. Not to say you can't, if you don't have that, you're going to be awful or something like yeah. that. But why do you think it's so hard to talk about this?
You know, it because when you start to diss or people take it as a diss to the fabric of who they are, the cultural identity, it people get offended by it, right? It's hard for humans, for people, to take responsibility for their own action. It's very difficult, you know, so people like to divert. In the black community, culture is what's really destroying us, right? I mean, it's culturally acceptable more now than it was, I don't know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, for you to be in a single-parent home. Back in the day, that's unheard of.
Yeah.
Back in the day, you know, having a family structure was all we depended on. As black people to build, we understood the value of it. Now,
right. It wasn't until I think late 60s, yeah. early 70s. I think early 70s yeah. when that flipped.
It's beginning to flip. And now it's cool to be on your own and do your thing as a young man. Oh, I don't, you know, listen to the music that most of us listen to. You know, banging a few girls here and there it makes you a man. You cool. You popular. You don't have to stay around with a woman. You can hit it, have a kid out of wedlock. Most of the dudes that's rapping, most of the potential leaders are doing the same thing. You know, so I think we've been set off on the wrong path. And when you're confronted with those issues, instead of internalizing and say, look, this is our fault. We need to get back to this. Why are we not marrying these women that we're having kids with? Why are women not having the expectation to date and to be with a man who's stable and who can provide for them? Not somebody that can provide for them for one night. You know, not somebody that can provide flashiness, but stability. You know, also in the culture, stability is almost viewed upon like you're acting white. When I was growing up and, you know, you would do well in school, people would say, well, you're trying to be like the white man. You know, if you want to have your pants right, like it's supposed to, tuck your shirt in and say, you know, I'm going to marry women. I'm not going to disrespect women. I'm telling you, I don't know how it is in every high school around the world, you know, in the black community, but I know how mine was. And you're getting shunned. I remember we had some guys who were virgins mm-hmm. in high school and in college. I mean, you get bullied.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with you if you're not having sex. That's cultural, man. And I feel like if that changed, we may be able to return back to saying, let's value our women, let's value relationships.
It's so interesting the way the media uses culture sort of against everybody. Did you see just in the last couple of days, there was this piece in Vox about how Andrew Yang should stop using toxic terms like math and that people should become doctors yeah. because yeah. those are associated with the Asian community, except those are the things we should all aspire for,
right, right.
and they're trying to make them toxic. And that's
right.
the reverse. Of what you're laying out there.
Yeah, exactly. And I just, that's what my goal is in life. is to give young brothers a different perspective. Now, don't get me wrong. I used to be sagging my pants. I had gold teeth in my mouth. I got Young Savage tattooed across my stomach. I got my hood tattooed on my forearms. You know, so I understand what it's like to be involved in that. I understand what it's like to want to be a part of that culture, but I also understand what it's like to change. You know, and it took me finding God to really take that step and change in a different direction. And I realized, man, this is the way things should be. We shouldn't be ashamed to be like this.
When was your spiritual awakening?
In 2008. I'll never forget it. You know, I was in college. You know, I had fun in college, you know, my first couple of years, but I had a terrible attitude. We couldn't sit across from each other because we would have probably never met. Anytime I felt offended by somebody, I'm ready to fight, you know, which was the detriment of my college career in football because the coaches yell at me, now I want to fight them. I didn't know how to handle my emotions well, and I didn't care. Cursed every word out of my mouth, you know, and a lot of things I really didn't care about that I care about now. Race was very different to me before I got saved. I saw black and white very clearly. Mm-hmm. I took Africana studies in college, and there was a period of time where I hated white people. I did. I felt so offended by what they did to my ancestors from the things they taught us in college.
Oh, yeah, so I was going to ask you, so do you think that was the intention of the classes? Because this goes across all the social
sciences.
You
know, I'm not sure back then. You know, I didn't feel what I feel today. Back when I went to the classes, I felt like that they were just teaching. And, of course, there's going to be a level of bias, right? If this is your perspective, you have the freedom to teach kind of in the direction you want. I didn't see them over, you know, propagandizing certain things. When I go to colleges and speak now, it is clear that they're trying to intentionally brainwash people into believing a certain thing. I had a young guy reach out to me. The books that were required was a book saying it was like anti-white man, why the black man is being oppressed. I mean, I didn't have those books growing up, or at least in college.
Go get a job after you've learned that. Like, right. What are you doing? What is the purpose of it?
How can you exist in an environment where you hate white people, but you're only 13% of the population? How can you exist in that environment? You're gonna find yourself hating almost everybody you're around. You're going to find yourself, you know, screwing yourself out of opportunities. Because if you're looking at your boss as the enemy, are you going to perform well in your job? Are you going to be more willing to try new things or go up in the ranks? Are you going to have the spirit for you to visualize success when all you think is you know that you're being oppressed by the white man? So some of that was in me growing up. You know, I grew up in an all black community. I never dated a white girl. It was shunned in my community. Growing up, you date a white woman, you're going to get bullied. You a sellout. You know, so I had none of that exposure. Never was really around white people consistently, mostly around black people. Everything in my life was Afrocentric. I got to college, and my eyes were open up to a certain degree because now everybody's white. And it's like 35 of us. You know, it is a little more than that. Probably about a couple hundred, but most of us were athletes.
Yeah.
And so I begin to see, like, you know, white people aren't as evil to as I thought they were.
So they weren't hunting you down.
They
on
weren't
campus.
Hunting us down. You could go eat with white people and nobody would be. There would be no controversy.
You were eating with white people.
Eating with white people.
Incredible.
Enough. but you thought there was going to be a lot of animosity.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, they're bad because we're in college. I'm telling you, this is a real thing.
What was that like, though, really? Like, it sounds so eating with white people. No one's hunting down. Like, but like that transition, as you were starting to realize it, to break the old mold of thinking, like, how hard is that?
For me, man, I'm a very stubborn person, but I'm a logical person. If I can see a logical example of truth and reality, then it's easier to convert me. If you can't show me that, I'll be stubborn to the day I die. But it was really eye-opening for me, man, because I perceived that people were going to treat me differently. I perceived that people were going to be shocked that black folks are going to college and that we're successful, and it wasn't at all. White people didn't care. You know what I'm saying? So. I'm white friends, and I'm like, man, you know, everybody's essentially the same. There's like two people in this world, real people and fake people. They come in different colors. And that began to change in me. And then, like I said, when I got saved, it was like, it's like God imparted in my heart that we're all the same, man.
So what was that spiritual wake-up moment?
Well, it was a lead-up to it, right? I mean, football wasn't going well for me. I had been going to church growing up. You know, we were in church, but church wasn't in us, right? We go to church and we leave. We listen to rap music and doing all that kind of other stuff. We didn't pray. We didn't read the Bible. So that's kind of our lukewarm Christian upbringing. And when I got to college, things weren't going well. Then I said, man, let me try God out. I was really going to rule God out. I said, let me see if this is real, man, because I'm in a point in my life where it's kind of a turning point. You know, I want to figure out who I am. Football's not going well. I thought it was going to be, you know, my life moving forward, and it's not happening. And I'm in a position where I don't know where to go. Let me rule this God thing out, and then I can go from there. And I was having visions and dreams and stuff of God. Jesus visited me in one of my dreams, like in a vision. And I went to a church. I got invited to Emmanuel Grace Apostolic Church. I'll never forget that church. And it just turned my life around. One day I went up to the front. I had a friend with me, and she was crying, you know, at the altar call. She's crying, and, you know, she want to, you know, find God. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, I'm going to take her up there because she's too scared. Let me take her to get her some pray for, because they pray for you at the front. And when I went up there, I ended up getting prayed for. And then I found myself getting baptized, and God really just changed me, man, completely. I'm talking about, it was a complete change. I went from cursing every day to never, when I say never cursing again, but a period of time, I never said a curse word. Now, sometimes people make me mad. I may not say it on the TV, but sometimes I do curse. But I didn't curse. I stopped listening to rap music completely, and my perspective of life just completely changed.
Maybe somebody, and I've heard this happen, I've had friends that have gotten throat cancer, nodules on their voice box to where they were not allowed to sing. Their doctor said, you cannot sing for 6 months or 8 months or whatever it is. People, listen, there are good excuses why you might not be able to sing, why you may not be able to be in the choir. And believe me, as a choir director of this church, as one of our choir directors, I don't like to admit the fact that there can be excuses. But let me say this. Also, as an administrative pastor, I also see the big picture when people begin to resign positions. It's going to get kind of weird. It's okay. You got me for 3 weeks.
Let's see where this goes. But I know nothing about policing. Nothing. Except when I got arrested when I was 8. And the agenda that you feel, you know, growing up in the black community, feeling like the cops always have to get you. And I did a ride-along, man, and it changed my life. Officer Sean Payne changed my life during that ride-along, and that kind of set my career up.
So you become a police officer. This is sort of a 180, as you just said, from where you started.
Right.
What was the most eye-opening thing about being an officer?
It was the idea that I had no idea what police did, and I thought I did, right? Watching cops, listening to people online. I realized that people that have never put on a badge and actually served as a police officer, they have very limited understanding of policing, period. I mean limited to like 10% of an understanding, mm-hmm. even less than that. If you know somebody that's a police, you may have a little more, but I had no idea. Completely a different world. It's completely a different job than people know about. Emotionally, legally, you know, the training, I mean, all of that is completely different. And if I got a taste of that, even after all the training, my first arrest was where I was like, this is real, man. This is real. I really have the power to take somebody's freedom away. And this is not a role player, what we call them in the academy, where somebody's faking to be a criminal. This is right. A real person with real emotions, a real life, and they can really kill you too. And that was a pivotal point and an eye-opening point for me.
What was it like? Did you ever go back to the old community and the guys that were giving you the weed as an 8-year-old?
Saw
you in your uniform?
No, growing up in Fort Worth, I became a police officer.
You weren't wearing.
But there was remnants of that, right? You had a black community in Tucson, and you arrested people that looked like people that you grew up with, act like people you grew up with, like my cousins and grandma, you know? And so dealing with that kind of give you a little, you know, flashbacks of what went on, and I got to see it from both sides. All of that horrible stuff I thought they did to us when we were in a vacant house, how they treated us and all that stuff, I realized that them officers was right. They did what they're supposed to do. Getting a call of that nature, not knowing who to expect, knowing that we die on a day-to-day basis from calls simply like that. And that really, you know, made me really, really open my understanding to it.
Yeah. What about racism within the police department, right? If you listen to half the media, you know, police departments, they're all racist. They're looking for racist ways to incarcerate people.
Yeah, it's the biggest load of crap I ever heard in my life. The biggest load of crap. Police, if people understood what policing was, you would understand that it's rare for a police officer to be actually a racist. Now, are there racist people on the police department? Yes. There's racist pastors. Come on. We all know that every walk of life, there's some idiot out there that's still lingering to hateful rhetoric.
Yeah. But doesn't it drive you crazy that you have to qualify it always with that? It drives me crazy all the time. Yes, there are homophobes. There are racists.
Yeah.
There are bad, mean people. Yeah. We cannot exterminate all of them.
Right.
Thanos could do it, but basically we can't, you know?
We can't, but some people need to know that because watching the media every day, if you're not an informed person or you're not a person that's a leader and you can lead with your own thoughts, you're a follower, you'll fall into that stuff. But it's very difficult to be a racist on a police department. And one of the biggest reasons why is because you can't pick who you serve. And the least racist people, in my opinion, are the white police officers that work in the black community. Because you put your life on the line every day for black folks. You are willing to die for black folks. You have to visually see and feel the pain and hurt in the community when brothers getting shot every day. People don't realize that police are the ones got to put those young brothers in body bags. I don't care who you are. When you see a young man with his brains hanging out, clinging for life, maybe even pleading for his life, gurgling in blood, the age of your son, the age of your nephew, cousin, somebody that looks like your mom, your grandmother, a young baby that's been shot through the head from a drive-by, I don't care what race you are, man. It messes with you. And for people to think that these white officers are these cruel, evil people that don't have any sense of emotions or attachment to human life, these people are the people that are pushing this rhetoric are evil and liars. You put these young people in body bags every day. You go to their mom, grandmother, and you look that lady in the face, trying to hold back your own tears because you could only imagine losing your son. Some of these women have lost all of their children to gang violence. And you got to look in the eye, and you got to be strong for her and everybody else and say, I'm sorry, but he's never coming back. And that's what people don't understand happens. And I also believe that it's racist, in my opinion, to make the projection that white officers are targeting black people in the community. And one of the main reasons is that you would have to assume that all black people are bad. Think about this for a minute. If officers are afraid of black people, that means that all of them are doing something that will lead officers to be afraid of them. That's not true.
Yeah.
It's only a few dummies that are destroying the community. What about grandma now who've been robbed? They call the police for help. Some woman have been raped. They call the police for help. Officers are seeing another side of black people that they don't want to tell you about, but they project it so people can be divided. And I think that's the biggest thing that bothers me about it.
So since you were probably uniquely positioned in Arizona as an officer to go to some of these communities and talk to some of these people, do you think you were able to wake up some young kids that were up to no good in a way that maybe a white officer just wouldn't have been able to, as well-intentioned as he might be?
I think young people and black people in general, you know, I was considered the black person whisperer, right? I'm serious. Like, we would go on calls, and black people would be like, oh, man, F that, you know what? I don't want to talk. Man, what a black officer. Man, come on, brother. Tell them tonight. They go to jail just like they would with the white officer. But somehow they felt compassion because they felt they can identify with me. And a lot of times they would listen to me articulate to them, brother, it ain't what you think it is. They didn't pull you over because you black. You think they care about your color of your skin? You got pulled over because you had a suspended driver's license or your suspended registration. Stop jumping to that conclusion because you are creating a scenario of frustration and conflict that doesn't need to be had. An officer just comes over to you doing a routine, what we call routine traffic stop, and now you hype. Oh, you pulled me over because I'm black. This is what that means to an officer when you say that, is that I'm a racist, right?
Yeah.
And I don't have any integrity at all.
Yeah.
And I didn't waste it all these years developing, building what I've established, and you're telling me that I'm willing to throw that away and I have no integrity, I don't care about my family, I don't care about my pension or nothing, because I want to racially profile you as if I'm that shallow-minded. Well, you better believe you're probably about to get a ticket. You know, and I think people don't understand it. They start to the conversation off very wrong when they do that. A lot of officers let it go.
Yeah.
But some officers that you catch on camera, sometimes they don't take it lightly.
Did you also get the reverse of that, though, where you go into these communities and then they'd see you and be like, well, this guy's the sellout.
Yeah.
Why would we talk to him?
Sometimes it would happen. More often than not, they felt that they could identify with me. One reason why, I think God kind of put an anointing on me that allowed me to reach people uniquely, black, white, or and, you know, whatever. The fact that I didn't curse on the job helped me reach people uniquely. Because when the stuff is hitting the fan, the only person that sounds is if he has integrity, or not just integrity, but sounds like he's calm. Just because I'm not yelling curse words, people attract to me. I feel like God gave me a gift to communicate as well. So I was able to communicate with people and you know, talk people out of suicide and all kinds of stuff.
What do you make of just sort of how the media treats all of the shootings? And that, you know, certain shootings, yeah, if it's a white cop and a black suspect, then we treat it a certain way. If it's a black,
yeah,
cop and a white one, we treat it differently. A lot of times the same people who are outraged over it one way, then the next day it happens the other way, then they ignore the story.
Yeah.
The way,
yeah,
we're, everyone's playing this really twisted game,
right,
with policing right now.
There's money in black people's emotions, right? We're probably the most emotional people, a group of people, if you want a group, in the country. Twice as many white people have been shot this year unarmed than black people in America. Almost every year, the case is that more white people get shot unarmed than black people. And white people are not going to be doing what black people are doing, right? I don't see white people protesting. I remember in New Mexico, they had a shooting in New Mexico. The officer shot the guy in the back. He was mentally ill, shot him in the back. I thought it was ridiculous for them to shoot the guy with the rifle in the back from such a distance. Killed him. It was a bad shooting. I think the officer got fired. They all got in trouble. White people aren't out here protesting. Black people, for some reason, I don't know if it's the legacy of slavery that got us in the mentality of feeling like we have to defend and be mob-like on certain occasions, but we are going to protest, right, wrong, or indifferent. The man can pull a gun and shoot an officer and he gets shot back. We will protest. I've seen it with my own eyes. The media understands that. So they don't care nothing about nobody. It's about if it bleeds, it leads, right? They know the black people are going to act a fool, so they're going to cover it. They're going to showcase it. They're going to act like there's this outrageous rate of white officers killing black people, which is not even true at all. White officers, or you say white officers, officers in general, you know, place in Philly is 50-50, black,
yeah,
and white.
Yeah.
But officers kill more white people, twice as many white people, as black people in shootings where people are armed. They kill more people unarmed, white, than black. And here's the thing that people always bring up. Well, there's more white people. Police officers don't deal with every single person in the population. They deal with the criminal element of the population. If you look at African Americans in America, you know what, we make up 12-13% of the population, yet we commit over half of the murders in this country, over half of the violent crimes in this country. So the bulk of criminal activity is coming from a small, let me clarify that. 13% of the population is way overblown number. It's more like 6 or 7% of the population. Because when you take out older people, young people, women, it's mostly young men between the age of, I don't know, 16 and 35 that are doing the bulk of these crimes. So let's say 6% is committing over half of the murders and violent crimes in this country. When you look at it like that, police have an overwhelmingly higher presence in the black community dealing with the criminal element. Yet they shoot more white people than they shoot black people. If you look at the proportionality of numbers, it's actually a less likely chance per capita that you get shot as a black man as opposed to white people in America. And that, to me, rules out the idea of the racist policing in America.
Do you think it's possible that we're going to also, and maybe we're there already, going to have a crisis in policing where good people,
yeah,
forget their skin color,
yeah,
which I would prefer to do all the time, but,
right,
but good people who are policemen won't want to work in black communities because they know it will,
yeah,
ultimately be an unwinnable situation. You'll either have them turning on the black officer like you and you're the sellout,
yeah,
and all that, and the white ones will just be like, well, forget this. There's no win in this. I could be a,
yeah,
great officer for 30 years,
right,
but one weird thing happens that gets twisted one way or another or edited,
yeah,
or whatever, and my career's over. So then you're going to get a, I don't even know how you call it, like a lower class of qualified people that are going to,
yeah,
work in the communities that need it the most.
Right, and then people are not going to—they're not going to be proactive in policing. We've already seen it happen. I mean, if people are now thinking that we're going to get to that point, you're
so
way
there.
Behind.
Yeah.
We're there. We were there from Ferguson. People don't realize it. The crime rate in these areas are skyrocketing. Officers, proactive policing is going down. The way, listen, police are responsive, right? They respond to crimes, right? If me and you got into an altercation, I pulled a gun, I shot you, they're not there before I shoot you. They come after the fact. But the greatness of policing, if it's done properly, is proactive policing. Therefore, they've already had contact with me, understood that I'm a danger. I've probably gotten arrested for crimes I've done before I shoot you. That is the way you police. But the reason, I mean, what they're doing today is they're killing the spirit of officers being proactive. Because you go, you see a guy doing a hand-to-hand. People without the experience in law enforcement will say, oh, just a hand-to-hand. No, that hand-to-hand has killed so many people in the community with drugs and crime and all this other stuff. We see that. We arrest the man hand-to-hand. We get into a scuffle with him. Now, police brutality, we get fired. Officer sees hand-to-hand and say, I'm not going to care more than the community does. Because it takes a lot, man, for you to risk life and death every day, putting your family through that, and you want to, at the end of the day, you want to get your pension. And you lose your pension over something you did correctly, over something that you were justified in doing, but because the community became outraged, you lose it all. We saw it in Baltimore. All you got to do is look at the stats. Baltimore, huge reduction in applicants. California, huge reduction in applicants. And we've seen this on the Tucson Police Department, and they won't tell the public because the chief is a piece of crap. But we had to dumb down the scores because we didn't have enough qualified people to join the police department. When I was there, you had to make a 75 or above. And this is a test that you can't study for. You got to come out the gate having a basic understanding. Now, I think they put it down to like 40%. Officers on the department are like, and I'm going to tell you this. Any department, you can look at the stats. Tucson is a big example. When they did this a while ago, you see officers getting fired all the time, officers doing bad stuff, they're skipping over backgrounds. It is making policing in America more dangerous by the rhetoric that they're spewing, which is false.
Yeah.
These are lies that they're telling you. Michael Brown, they're still talking about hands up, don't shoot. Lie. Eric Garner, I will fight to the death about the justification of use of force against Eric Garner. Tamir Rice, all of these shootings and all these things, if you're a police officer, you understand that these are justified uses of force. People conflate the two. Justified killings is what they call it, or killing somebody versus the justification of use of force. There's a big difference. They weren't trying to kill Eric Garner. The dude was fat, overweight, heart condition. You use any force against him, he's going to go into cardiac arrest. He's like a ticking time bomb. They weren't trying to kill Tamir Rice, the young kid, that he had to pull the gun on him. He got put in a bad position. He used force against him. Unfortunately, that one shot caused his death. So people begin to conflate the two. We can never address the real issue because we're not talking about real problems.
Right. And the interesting thing is, of course, you're not defending the incidences when they're genuinely are bad guys. But what people always forget about is that constant threat that you guys are under. You just don't know what's going to happen on a knife's edge, whether that guy has a gun or the other thing. So sometimes you have to be what would, I guess, appear to be visually more careful than maybe the average person would want you to be.
Well, this is what I teach you in academy. And I know this is not popular. People would probably be mad at me for saying this. We get taught in academy, and when I first said this to me, I thought it was the most extreme thing in the world. I'm like, oh, they're going too far. What they teach you in academy is that you, and not everywhere, where I went in my academy, you have to be prepared to kill every single person you interact with. You have to be prepared emotionally to kill every person that you interact with. Because if you're not, you're going to die. You're going to get killed, and you're going to get all your other buddies killed. So you have to be able to have the mindset that at any moment this person can turn on me, whether or not they're a kid, whether or not they're an elderly woman, because we've seen the spectrum of officers getting killed by all kinds of people. You have to be prepared for that. And people don't understand our perspective. This is not a video game. You don't get to hit the reset button. When you die for real, and you're gone forever. And the unique part of what we see is that we see people die every day. We see the last breath. We see a person pleading for their life. And in the officer's mind, it's like, I don't want to look like that when I die. I don't want my family to see me like this guy. I don't want to be in my last breath not being able to talk to my son on the phone. You need to do the right thing, or I'm going to, if it's me or you, I'm going to win. People pose threats all the time, right? You just think about how many. I pulled my gun when I was an officer, four or five times a week. People have guns. I didn't escape death I don't know how many times. People don't see that side.
Mm-hmm.
Every officer has their own perspective about life, right? We may go to the same call. You may have been shot before. I've never been shot, so I'm grinning behind there. I'm driving in there. No caution.
Yeah.
That other officer may have a reflection in the mind of, man, last time I got shot because I did this. Last time I got shot, I seen the guy pull it from here, but I didn't react fast enough. They get to the call. Here he go. Mm-hmm. Pulling, name shot. You get what I'm saying? So the moral of the story is that we do go through a lot, and if people understood, they would be able to see these shootings in a much clearer light.
All right, so let's shift this a little bit to politics, which will get us to Blexit. So most of the cities, and you mentioned Ferguson, you mentioned Baltimore, the cities where there are the most shootings, Chicago, we can go through the list of these cities. Right. People don't seem to want to accept this, or at least mainstream media doesn't want to accept this, that these are Democrat-run cities.
Right.
But I thought Democrats like black people more than you mean Republicans.
Yeah, yeah. What's
the problem here? Something's not adding up.
Because it's not true.
I can't believe
it. It's like if the standard is 2 + 2 = 4 and you see an equation that says 2 + 2 = 3, it's something wrong there. People are not it's politically expedient for them to evade the issue. And you say, well, the virtue of having a D behind your name is no, it's not. It's the policies. Think about this. Who's anti-police? Democrats. And what are they doing? They're causing police not to act. They're causing police to be the enemy of the people. People aren't snitching. They're not cooperating with police. Now crimes aren't being solved. Those things have issues. They want you to be on food stamps. They don't want you to be independent. They don't want you to go out and get it on your own. They don't want jobs to come to your community. They don't want that. They need you to need them so they can win votes.
When you say they, are you talking about like the
Democratic elite?
You're talking about the political class.
Political class.
Because I believe even for, I mean, you know enough about my political evolution, for as frustrated as I am with the lefties these days, most of them I think are just misguided. I don't think they're bad people. I don't think they're really trying to screw over black people or something like that. The elite do it, and they're easy bumper sticker answers. Give more money to this community for this. Sounds good. Get the police out. Their police are killing. Like, it all sounds kind of right. But I don't think the average person actually believes that.
No.
But it's breaking through that layer of craziness.
It's not the people, right? Yeah. You can even look at this in a spiritual sense of a pastor, right? The people, the lay members, are receiving information from the pastor in hopes that he's acting in good faith to project the gospel, right? He said he got a degree. You believe him. You're learning from him. People in the Democratic Party, the people, the lay members, they are listening to these politicians hoping that they're telling you the truth about immigration.
He said Republicans are all racist.
You're right. So you're hoping that they're telling you the truth, but they're lying to you, and it's the people at the top. Most of these Democratic people that are running for Congress, I'm not even every Democratic person in the House. There's some people that are like, they're a little more reasonable. But the party line idea, the party line politics is what's destroying people. And it's almost like this. Look, I equate slavery and then the freedom of slaves to the Democratic Party today. And this is how I compare the two. When slaves were on a plantation, they knew it was wrong, whatever the case may be. The slaves didn't want to be there. But when they got free, what did the slave master tell them? Oh, wait. How are you going to survive out there on your own? Who's going to take care of you? You're going to have food. We can feed you. We'll take care of you. Make sure you're safe. Stay here in slavery. And a lot of slaves did. They felt comfortable. They didn't want to go out on their own and risk the big bad world. Become entrepreneurs. Be free. The Democratic Party is almost the same similar concept because black folks need to be free. We need to understand that we can be entrepreneurs. We can be flight attendant. We can do it all. They don't want you to go into this big, bad world and fail. Failure is only a pathway to success. If you never fail, you will never be successful. They don't want you to get off the plantation. They want you to stay so they can coddle you. And then what? Our communities become desolate. No real spirit of the community.
And dependent on them.
Right.
Them being the government. You know, it's interesting because everything you just said is basically what Kanye said about the mentality of slavery. And then what happened? Well, mainstream media said he should be in a mental institution.
Right.
Remember
they
that?
They have to. These people are working together. I don't know if it's people behind the scene paying money or what. They're working together to push an agenda. Netflix. I mean, all these things that are run by some of these Democratic elites. They have to. They can't. You can't ruin their reign over the people.
Yeah.
There's a difference between, and I'm not saying every Republican, right? I'm more of a Trump Republican, right? I don't like some of these people in the Republican Party, and I think they haven't done much for the black community anyway. Their outreach has been poor to me. I never seen none of them.
Yeah.
I never even knew they existed until I decided to, you know, look on the other side. But when you look at it for what it is, you know, the people in the Democratic Party, their focus is on power. More so in the conservative movement or in the Republican Party, their focus is the people more so often. We want you to be free, less government, whatever. The Democrats want power by any means necessary. They will support border wall. They will support strong immigration reform. Then, when it's not advantageous for votes, they will switch it in the same conversation they're having with you and act like it never happened. As a person who's new to politics, just seeing Chuck Schumer and all of them once just advocate. Barack Obama deported the most people in United States history out of any president. And then they turn and they cry on TV. And they make up this stuff. They tell you if you come to a port of entry, you're going to be separated from your family, which is a lie. If you come to a port of entry and you seek asylum, you go through a process for them to verify your asylum-seeking request. If you get busted over here or you're trying to sneak through the border, that's when you get separated because now you're going through a criminal proceeding. They know that, but they'll never tell you because they need the votes. They need power. Why haven't any of these candidates been pandering as much to black folks? Think about this. They speaking in Spanish. They on there talking about they're going to give every illegal free health care.
Yeah.
They want to get housing. Why are they not saying we're going to fix Chicago?
I think I know where you're going.
We're
going
to fix the school system because we are being replaced. We 13% of the population. How much do our vote really count? Now the Hispanic community or even the legals are coming in by the millions. I don't know. In about 10 years. They'll never need another black person again to vote because our vote won't count.
Well, not only that, but if you get 90-some-odd percent of a group's vote, then you don't have to give them anything. If you know and that was the brilliance of Trump saying, well, what do you have to lose?
Yeah.
Because, all right, we're giving this group 90-something, I think it's 94% or something like that.
In some areas, it's 100%. It's mostly on the 90 percentile.
Yeah, it's like, well, then, well, we don't worry about those guys. We got them taken care of already. Yeah. You know, we got that box checked.
And what I preach often is that it's not about the Republican Democratic Party. It's about leaving people who ain't doing nothing for you. And in many of these cases in the inner city, you've been voting for them 40 years. You still complaining. You still ain't got nothing. You still blaming people. Don't blame the Republican white man because the Republicans ain't even in your community. They ain't talking to you. They're not doing nothing for you. Blame the people who are there in your community perpetuating these things. Stop voting for them.
There's a They say
this doesn't show that we need Jesus now, nothing will. Blog Talk Mom.
That was excellent. I thank you and Bob Bill for this program tonight. It was absolutely over the top excellent. It seemed like I just feel such an awareness of our extreme need for connecting with God with all of our heart and not trying to debate it or, you know what I mean, just it's something that only God can take care of. And it was, I really, really enjoyed it. That every part of it, it's just amazing. I know Wild Bill has some things he shared with me when he was speaking with me earlier, and I love the balance that he is showing in all of it. And just to put this together, I'm just so thankful, so proud that I have y'all to for me. I love you so very, very much. Will he be able to share anything with us tonight, Sister Sharla?
Oh, I'm sure. But it definitely gives you a different perspective. Oh, here he is.
Hey, appreciate the kind words about the show. It's one of those things, if we can't realize that we're all in this same boat together, that everyone is our brother and everyone's our sister, and you know, the communication is there and the hidden agendas behind things, and a lot of it's just misunderstanding. And then, you know, Blog Talk Mom, she probably didn't. One of the biggest problems we have right now is a system that's set up before they get into the legal system. You know, where parents are doing stupid things, they shacking up with somebody and he's a drug dealer or something like that. And if they get caught, then these kids go into a social system that is, it's just bad. It's just bad. And there's got to be some way to help these children. And I love what Blog Talk Mom did for years, where, you know, she had it set up where she was teaching them Bible and, you know, giving them a chance to have relationships, you know, with some white kids their age and with her, and then, you know, then come up with the gospel rap like she did. And it wasn't, in her mind, it was no agenda to any of this, but listening to this and looking at that, you can see how God is trying to move. It's almost sad that we can't have it fixed to where that the church is not reaching out more for these kids that are in these damaged situations, because some of these people that are taking these kids is worse than what they came from living at home. And so it's not fixing things. It's causing more hatred and it's making things more divided instead of putting things together. And you know, something Blog Talk Mom shared with me, you know, I felt like my dad was a pretty good dad. He, you know, he's one of those things, if I didn't do something right, he'd beat the snot out of me. You know, I was accountable for my own actions. If we said the N-word when I was a kid, we got our mouth washed out with soap. And my dad took time to sit down to me and told me the N-word was not a race word, it's a class of people. And there's both black and white that fit that profile of what it is. And he was teaching me this back in the early 70s, where we had just come out of the race riots of the 60s and things. And I was just a little kid, so I don't really have clear perception of all that. But I was aware that everybody was afraid of everybody. The blacks were afraid of the whites were afraid of the blacks. And everyone wanted to show that they were man, you know, you're not going to run over me. And so they were killing each other. It's a vicious cycle. But really and truly, when I was a policeman in Sheridan, Arkansas, there was no black kids in the school there at all, none. And the county schools shut down where a lot of them went. And so they were coming into that school, and they had state police. They had people there from other departments to come in and cover. The news people were there. And it was funny, the only people that were, there was any bigotry about the whole thing was the parents. The kids got along great. They didn't have any problems at all. It was one of those things, it was just new. You know how it is when you're new to a school and they had to go through that process, but everybody wanted to be new friends. You know, they wanted to bring them into their circle. And there was no racism or anything there. And I like what everyone that you heard speak on this show, except for the guy that was asking the questions at the end, was black. They were actors. They were rappers. They're professional singers or athletes. Everyone you heard on there, except for, like I said, the guy giving the interview with the man that used to be a policeman, was every one of those were black people talking about how they see this whole thing, how they understand. You know, people have no clue what it's like to be a policeman. When you go there, you know that things can go from being like a what we call a routine call. And they tell you at the police academy, there is no such thing. But it can go from being a routine call to you're sitting there in the mud in someone's front yard and you're trying to keep someone from stabbing you with a knife. And 9 times out of 10, it could be because a woman called because her husband was beating her, and you're arresting him, going to put him in jail, and all of a sudden the wife decides that she's going to stab you in the back. So do you have someone else there, Charlotte? Did you turn on someone else's mic? If you're there, Charlotte, you've muted yourself. Well, I guess I'm hearing things.
Nobody.
I swore it down. I heard someone call my name.
No, you didn't. I'm hearing some sort of noise, but it must be on your end.
Yeah, it could be picking up through my headset here. Somebody else getting in their truck and their headset's trying to connect to my phone. But, you know,
like Charlotte said,
at the end of this, is because it's picking up on my headset, it's not picking up on yours.
Oh, that's good.
There's about 20 trucks here, and every one of us got a headset. So, but, you know, Barclay, I mean, really, did you even realize when you were doing that with the safe place for these kids, you know, actually how that fit into a need for the community beyond a spiritual need? Did you ever even think about that?
It's just more or less, I don't even know. It's like a calling for me. I have there's a lot of situations. Children that they steal. You know, I've had about 6, and then there's so many problems, and you can't make a contact with the parent to try to create an answer. It's a serious problem. So that I really don't have the answers except. Back to, it's better to light one candle than curse the darkness, as far as I'm concerned. So there were so many. Now, I do try to use wisdom and restrictions with some of the things that are just obvious. But like you said, some of the situations that are supposed to be created to help in our society are not helping. They are bizarre. I've had one young woman reach out to me. She had gone to court and that picked up a child that there was no place for him to go. I went to out to Whitfield, which is to help a group there to minister, and there was 30 to 40 children there. They hadn't done anything wrong. Their caregivers had been incarcerated, and there they were. And by the way, there was one of the most awesome moves of God when I began to share with them. And, you know, I know how what people just put wrath all in one category, and it's not, because mine certainly is not that type of wrath that would ever instigate any kind of hatred or anything. It's the Word of God. And but anyway, it's such a big problem, Wild Bill. It's bigger than, it's just so big. Because this is the sad part, with all the situations that I'm involved in right now and helping children, if anything went wrong, I would be the one possibly that would be held responsible. It's just some people back off because of that. They don't want to get involved. But I am going to get involved by the grace of God, because it's a blessing that God has given me. One young man, I guess he was 9, 10, first time he'd come up this week to my house, and they were going to meet later on so that he could tell his dad that he wasn't his dad anymore, because there was a divorce, and he was trying to be very articulate, and, you know, but you could tell his heart was breaking, because it was his real father. And that book, The Field of the Fatherless, goes along with everything that was said tonight on your program, because there must be fathers that are fathers that really care and give discipline. And I know it can be pretty
you know, discipline's not fun, but I like the way he mentioned it, and I like the way you mentioned it, and I'm sure that the discipline that I received, which was seemed harsh, and I gave up to you and your sister, I was too harsh, but it's still a very helpful source in helping people to have a structure to their life and appreciating. And this program is like my heart is just so stirred. It's really an unusual thing. I always think of this one particular thing. We moved to Detroit and from Arkansas, and there had been at that point a tremendous, horrible race riot. They had tanks in the street. It was really, I never had seen anything comparable to it. And me and my cousin sort of snuck out of the house one day, and we was out playing in behind the house. There was a big open place behind this business, and it was just, I don't know. Anyway, he thought it would be cute to take my scarf. I had a silk scarf around my neck, and he thought it'd be cute to tighten it, and like he was going to choke me, which it did. It was strangling. I literally was dying, and I could not breathe. And this really handsome young man, black man, came by, and he popped out a switchblade, cut it, smiled at me. Later on, I got to meet him when I started school that year. But I don't know. My mind just goes so many directions on how my feelings run extremely deep against any type of racism at all. I have no place for that in my heart or in my life. So, but I do know that there is a real thing. It's a very, very real thing. So is hatred towards anything, towards the Jews. You know, the Jewish people, there's a group of people that just think they can't be saved and they're all this and all that, which is so bizarre. But I didn't mean to ramble, which I am, and so I will shut up and let you talk while, Bill.
No, I was enjoying everything you had to say, and I think that there were several other things I listened to that talked about that there's white people that's getting involved in this mob mentality because they want to show that they're not racist, and so they're getting involved in the mob situation. And like this, several people said here, what is it? What is the benefit? What are you looking to happen when you go out there and you're stealing everything out of a store and you're setting it on fire, or you're throwing gasoline on policemen, they're trying to throw fireworks on them to ignite them on fire? You know, what is it you're hoping to happen? It's not anything there that's going to help the cause. And the majority of black people have figured this out. We have to remember, even though it looks like there's huge numbers on the street, that somebody has an agenda here. It's clear the way all this stuff was organized. I loved how this man was going to delete the whole thing on politics, but he went full circle to show that he wasn't real happy with either party. You know, and so there was a balance here. I like keeping things in balance. So when I was doing all the things when Obama was president, I didn't like the soundbite news because people were taking his speeches out of context. I didn't like that, you know, so I was there to put that in. I do the same thing with Trump, some of the things he's done. I think he's in a situation that no president has ever been under. And what really has shocked me about the whole thing is how, and I started to say this a minute ago, and I stopped, and I thought, no, I'm not going to go there. But I was talking about my dad. He worked hard all of his life. He paid his bills. He taught me that anything I wanted to have, I needed to establish my own value and go out and work for it, not to expect anybody to give me anything. You know, to be a man, to stand up. When things get hard, you just suck it up and you go on. And that's been something that's helped me all through my life, and especially when I had that accident where I got all this neck and back issues. You know, I can make a lot of excuses and try to get on some kind of disability program, and my company's tried to push me into doing that. But through the grace of God and praying parents and praying people at church, I've got the grit to go do it, and God makes a way that I can do it. And so, but, you know, I saw all these thousands of people yesterday going to go see this man that was killed in this incident. And I'm like, you know, did he come up with a cure for cancer? You know, did he, what did he do that the vice president that ex-vice president is running for office for the office of president. What did he do to deserve all those people being in his house and being in his family? Where were these people at when my dad died? He paid his taxes. He worked hard every day of his life. He came from almost nothing. And, you know, he taught me to work, you know, the things that were there. So why didn't somebody running for office want to come up here when he died? You know, the whole balance of all this stuff is so skewed. The governor or the mayor of Minneapolis got himself in a hot. He was trying to be politically correct and answered everything that they said with yes. And next thing you know, he didn't realize that he said that he was going to shut down the police department for the city of Minneapolis. And now he's either got to look more like an idiot and stand up and say, no, I was wrong in what I was saying. And now they're trying to come up with all these stupid things. I don't know if you've been keeping up with this, but these stupid things like, well, you know, because we live in, you know, nice houses and got police protections, we act like that makes us superior to the poor black men that don't have those things. I'm like, what? Where's this stuff coming from? What is this? So anyway, I'm thankful. I am so thankful that I was born in the United States of America. I think that this is the greatest country in the world. I think that we're going through a spiritual time to where God is going to call his people to step up to a higher level. We're going to see more separation between those that are sincere to give God their all to those that just want to give God a portion. And God don't want just a portion. He wants it all. He wants everything we have to give it to him, to seek him with all our heart, you know, all of our minds, all of our, everything we have, he wants it all. And then he wants us to trust him. And we're going to be in situations where trust is going to be something that's not just a word. I really believe that. We're going to really have to do some trusting in this whole situation. But, you know, I can tell you this. God's never lost a battle. He's never failed. He cannot lie. He's watching over his word to perform it in the lives of his people. And if we just lock in on those few things right there, and then you add to the whole thing that when we were yet sinners, our sin was crime against God, he loved us. And he had a plan that he was going to die for us to make a way of escape for something that we did against him. Something you can't fathom in all these things here. And I had some other songs I started to play about, you know, love and different things and going back to, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, Coca-Cola had a commercial where I like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, you know, and people going hand in hand. And there was a thing in 86 where I forgot all about it. We did a thing where we went from New York City all the way to San Francisco, California. We had hands all grouped together, black, white, Hispanic, whatever it was. They went from New York all the way to California. There was a hand being touched all the way across there. In one day they did it. People said it was impossible to set that up, and they did it. So if we, of the people of faith, have a heart to pray about these things that we're seeing that's going on, and not be angry, not fall into the trap of being angry and not falling into the trap of being judgmental, but if we can let the love of God shine forth through us, because we all know that our love is not sufficient. And I've always been a people person. I was really blessed in the black communities where I work. I got along with people really well. But what I saw is the one time someone tried to sue me, and when it was going to court and there was things said about me in the paper and everything, it was really strange. None of those people wanted to talk to me anymore. They'd look the other way when I'd come in, knowing that the stuff, I guess they knew it wasn't true. But, you know, it was just so strange that one thing there. It's like people feel like they have to choose a side. And so because it was a black person involved, they felt like they had to choose a side, and it wasn't my side. And I was shocked. You know, I went to a black city alderman who knew me very well and wanted her to be one of the people, to be one of my character witnesses. And she told me no, she would not do it. After me taking 3 weeks to get her to where she'd even talk to me, and then it was on the phone. So there's some big things here, but I'm so thankful that this ain't like it was in the 60s, that with the people, the peaceful protests, you're seeing black and whites together. Back in the 60s, what did you see? You saw black people, and then on the other side you saw white people with fire hoses and big old long nightsticks and German Shepherd dogs, and the hatred was something you could cut with a knife that was there. And so I'm so thankful that we have evolved to where we are today. And I have a confidence of heart that God is going to be the thing, like it was for his man. He talked about going to an apostolic church and getting baptized, how that changed his life. And I think there were some more things he would like to go into, but the type show it was, he didn't. But that's going to be the key, is when we allow God to let us realize that we're all his children, all of us. He died for all of us. He loves all of us. And so who are we to try to put ourselves above God? So anyway, that's all I have for you guys tonight. And I'm hoping that this didn't offend anybody. That wasn't the purpose of this. I have a lot of people I've been trying to explain what it's like to be a policeman and what it is to go on calls. And even trying to talk to Mom, she couldn't relate to what I was saying. She, you know, and it's hard for someone to realize that every situation you go to could turn into something where you could lose your life. And you know that. They teach you that in a police academy. And so, you know, you have to be aware. I did this one thing one time and ended up getting my head busted, you know, so I'm going to be more on edge. And you see someone do that again, and then you're like, how could that policeman shoot that man that was unarmed? But he sees this man moving, and next thing you know, he's shot. I got a friend of mine, I probably shared this before, in his church, because of all these things that's going on with church setting up security, he's one of the people that carries a gun in his church in case they have a live shooter situation. And he was saying when they went through the training, they had a company come in, and they had this guy standing in front of them. And the guy that was with him, there's two guys there, they're petting down this one guy that came into the church that something wasn't quite right with. And anyway, when they take their first step back, this guy, they got their guns in their hands pointed at him. Before they could shoot the gun, he pulls the gun from out of his belt, pulls it up, and shoots both of them twice before they could fire one shot. And my friend was amazed. He said, you kept telling me these things happen so fast, and you got to be mentally prepared for that thing to happen before it does. And he's like, I had no clue. I could not relate to that fast. I could have been dead in that situation, thinking I was doing everything right, thinking I was safe. There was two of us there, thinking I'm safe. I've already got a gun in my hand. And then they both got shot twice. They would have been dead. What would really be perfect would be is if we just didn't have any more crime. But unfortunately, as long as there's sin in the world, I don't see that happening right now. So, but anyway, I said to Mingo, that's all I had to say, and it really is. I love everybody, and I work here with some great black people over here with Holland, and they're my brother just like the white people are. The guy left his wallet in the truck the other day, and I didn't even open it up to see who it was. I felt like I knew who left it in here, and I just took it into the office. And he was just so – he knew that that was the type of person I was. You know, he was so pleased that I was the one that found it. And so, you know, I don't know. This is one of those things you can go in, like Mom says, you consider get rattling on this stuff. But, you know, we just have to believe that God sets people up on thrones. He's the one that brings them down. Whatever's going to happen in the elections and stuff, this is all part of God's plan. And so, anyway, back to you guys, Darla.
Well, Black Hat Mom, do you have anything?
Well, just to repeat the wonderful thought that was told at one of our services, Satan has a plot, but God has a plan, just like Wild Bill said. Satan has a plot to counterfeit, to hurt, to destroy, and if he was had a brain of any kind, he's sure not crucified the Lord, because of that, 3 days later, God came out victorious over death, hell, and the grave. And we that follow the plan of God, like the part of the message tonight that the young man was saying, when he came to God, when he repented, when he was saved, when he was baptized, and his sins were washed away, no doubt he was filled gloriously with God's Spirit. That's the plan. And if we could get just a little bit more grieved over Jesus going, for me and for you and for each of us, he didn't do anything wrong. He certainly had never done anything wrong. Never without sin. But because of us, he was willing to take not only his death, but the most horrible beating that the prophet Isaiah could describe that ever happened to a man. No man, it said, no one was ever beaten and mistreated like our Savior. And he did it for each of us so that we can be saved. So if we want to protest, let's don't be like the devil and protest against something that is totally out of our hands. Let's fall on our face before God and ask Him, Lord, I want to be right. I want to live for You with all my heart. I want to love my fellow man, every one of them. I want to light a candle, not just curse the darkness. I love that saying, light a candle. Don't curse the darkness. You'll run out of breath. You'll get a sore throat. But when you light that candle, you'll find there'll be those all around that are seeking the light. And we are the light of the world and the salt of the earth. So our God tells us when He lives within us. I love this program. I love y'all. And thank you very much for my opportunity to share in it. And I will look very much forward to next week. God bless you.
Well, God bless you. Love Talk Mom. We love and appreciate you so much. And Wild Bill. And we pray that we would become a nation of prayer warriors. Because we need prayer warriors right now. That God would bless this nation once again before He comes back for His bride. We want to thank our listeners who listen to us faithfully, and we pray that you all have a very blessed week. And we'll see you back here next week at your place. Good night.